Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
And now, today in Baghdad, explosions killed 15 people. The attacks were carried out as final election results were released, confirming that Shiite parties will dominate Iraq's new government. Today is also the day the kidnappers of reporter Jill Carroll say they will kill the 28-year-old reporter if authorities don't release Iraqi women prisoners. Earlier this morning, one of Iraq's most influential Sunni leaders called for Carroll to be freed. Adnan Dulami, head of a Sunni political group, was the man Carroll was on her way to interview when she was kidnapped on January 7th. Well, joining us first on the line from Baghdad is Liz Sly, a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. She's based in Baghdad. And Liz, first of all, is there any news, any late news on Jill Carroll?
No, we don't have any news, which, of course, at this point in time is good news because 3 days ago the captors gave a 3-day deadline for executing her. So I think we're all hoping that there isn't any news today.
Is there any sign that the U.S. military is planning to release 6 women from detention? The request from her kidnappers had been that all 8 Iraqi females be released. Iraqi officials said they were going to release the 6. Unrelated to that demand, but what's happened?
Well, we don't have any word on that either. The Americans have said they are planning on releasing 6 women prisoners. They say it's unrelated to this case. Of course, we'll never know about that, or we might not ever know. We haven't heard that they have been released. And the captors' demand was actually that all female prisoners in Iraq be released. So what we don't really know is whether there's like one female who might be related to one of the kidnappers they specifically want out and who that might be, and whether these 6, if they're freed, would make a difference or not.
Yeah. Liz, we understand that while you weren't close to Jill Carroll, you did know her. It's a community of reporters in Baghdad. How are you and other reporters reacting to her capture? Does it affect the way you do the job? Has it had a predictable chilling effect?
Well, yes, it's had a very chilling effect on the mood here. Certainly everybody is much more aware of their movements than they were before. We're trying to avoid all neighborhoods where there's known insurgent activity. In the past, we might have slipped into some neighborhoods to interview some politicians. At the moment, we're just staying away, and everybody's staying in close touch. But there's really not a lot that can be done, and I think people are trying to just concentrate on the job and not think about it too much, and they're hoping and praying and keeping their fingers crossed.
Yeah. In the meantime, as we said, before we let you go, the final election results have been released. It was predicted there'd be violence at the release of the election results and during election time, and there has been. Was there anything in the results that was surprising or cause for concern?
Well, I think there was nothing surprising, and there is cause for concern. I mean, basically, it's going to lead to a parliament and a government that's very much dominated by the Shiites and Kurds, as was the case with the last parliament and the last government. And the Sunnis feel very excluded from that. They don't like the separatist inclinations of these groups, which are based in the south and based in the north. And obviously, negotiations are now going to begin on the formation of a new government, and the Sunnis will be hoping for a big stake in that. But if they don't get a big stake, I think we could see more violence for sure.
Liz Sly, reporter for the Chicago Tribune, based in Baghdad. She's speaking to us from there. And Liz, we really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, staying with the story of Jill Carroll, we turn now to Jackie Spinner, the former Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post and a friend of kidnapped journalist Jill Carroll. Jackie joins us from Washington. I can't imagine how you're feeling today.
Well, it's a very hard day, not only for me, but I can only imagine what her family is going through. Mm-hmm. Waiting. It's got to be the most awful feeling for them.
Well, and a picture has emerged of Jill Carroll, an extremely dedicated journalist, someone interested in the region, speaks the language, had come to consider Iraq home. What would you want to add to that?
Well, as Jill's mother said yesterday in her very powerful and moving statement, Jill is not an enemy of the country. And that's sort of the hardest thing, I think, for all of us who know her work professionally. Jill fell in love with Iraq, and she wanted to be there. And she was going to interview Delamy because she wanted to hear what he had to say. She was interested in talking to Sunni politicians, and she was willing to take the risk to find them in some of the most dangerous places in the country.
You mentioned the Sunni leader that Jill was on her way to interview, and early reports made it sound as if he wasn't there when she went, leading some to think that much of the violence in the region is Sunni-backed, that perhaps he had something to do with her abduction. Now he's come out with a statement against the abduction. Is there a sense of more known about who these abductors are?
I don't think we still have any idea of not only who these abductors are, but what their motivations might be beyond the fact that Jill is an American and she's a journalist, and in Iraq, that means she's a target.
And we talked about the chilling effect that that's been having. 60 journalists have been killed in Iraq since the U.S. invasion in 2003, and we rush to say most of them Iraqi journalists trying to help Americans in many cases. Are journalists still wanting to go there? What are you finding?
I think that it has had a chilling effect in the sense that there are journalists who might have wanted to go to the region and who are not going. But I think those of us who have spent a considerable amount of time in Baghdad, I include myself as one of those, won't be stopped by this sort of thing because we feel so compelled to be there to find the story and to tell the truth about what's going on there. These risks are not new, and journalists are still coming into the country and trying to report the story.
And by the way, what do you tell your journalists there in light of Jill Carroll's and the other abductions, but in light of hers? Is there some new advice to journalists?
Well, I think this is just a reminder that journalists have to be aware, and we can't let our guard down. There are moments in Baghdad, for example, where you could have days of no car bombings. They don't happen very often. And I think that you can get lulled into a sense of false sense of security. And we have to be mindful, not only for ourselves, but for our Iraqi staff.
Jackie Spinner is the former Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post, a friend of kidnapped journalist Jill Carroll. Carroll's abductors had said that she would be executed today if their demands weren't met, demands that all female Iraqi prisoners be released. Jackie, thanks for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Well, we now turn to Michael Guerin, a filmmaker who was kidnapped along with his translator Amir in August of 2004. They were both held for 10 days by a Shiite group local to the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr before being released after the work of Micah's partner Marie-Helene Carlton, who became his fiancée. They've been on the program to talk about it, and Micah, we welcome you back.
Thank you.
What are you thinking today? I mean, you who spent 10 days in captivity.
Well, you know, it's an extremely difficult time for both Jill and her family, and it's one of those things that, you know, when I see how the news is unfolding over the last couple of days, I am a bit heartened by the incredible number of Muslim voices who've come out in support of her.
Groups have come from America, Britain, and voices, as we've heard, raised in Iraq, some saying, I will be placing myself in danger for saying this, but please print, and this was to the Christian Science Monitor where Jill Carroll worked, please print that I abhor this abduction. They do seem to be putting themselves in jeopardy even more than ever in the past.
Yeah, I mean, it really is an incredible thing. You know, the Iraqi Accordance Front, the Muslim Scholars Association, the list goes on and on, and I think that's just, you know, a real testament to who Jill is.
Micah, have you been involved at all in trying to secure Jill's release?
Well, we've been offering advice, you know, on whatever basis we can and reaching out to our contacts, and the most important thing is that the entire journalist community, literally, is involved. I mean, people do this because they're concerned, and it's a small community, and everybody sort of knows everybody or knows of everybody else. So it's amazing to see how many people are extending themselves and doing whatever they can, whether it's just, you know, calling on friends or speaking to politicians or talking to their translators. You know, there's just such a groundswell of activity, and I think again that activity is evidenced in what we see coming from these groups in Iraq, you know, which is where it really matters.
What do you mean by that? Because some would say, well, gee, that activity might signal to a potential kidnapper, whoa, I can get a lot of attention if I do this. I mean, isn't there a slippery slope?
Right. And of course, that's true. But what really matters is that the information about who Jill is gets out there. So it's very clear that she is just a reporter and that she's a reporter, of terrific integrity, you know, a very, very honest, sympathetic person. And that's what really matters, because you need friends of friends to kind of get out there, and it encourages other people, you know, people who might actually have influence with her captors to speak as well.
This is what happened for you.
Yeah, exactly. It was just, in my case, it was also this enormous groundswelling of support, and it made a difference. In the end, Sauter made a statement saying that, you know, condemning kidnapping and saying that I should be released, and a few days later I was.
The group that claims to have kidnapped Jill Carroll calls itself the Revenge Brigade. Do we know any more about this group? And is that one of the scary things, that it's not a better-known group?
Well, you know, these groups, they're very difficult to know anything about them, because they sometimes they change their names, sometimes they, you know, deliberately hide their identities. Sometimes they're just small groups. And again, you know, in Iraq right now, the reasons for kidnapping kind of go across the gamut. So it could be political, it could be revenge, it could be about money, and it's just so hard to know until you get real information, real contact with who these people are.
You know, you mentioned that, and it makes me think and immediately feel a little badly, actually, that we actually know Iraqis here in the States, one living right here in Massachusetts who's helped us on the program, who has a family member who's been kidnapped in Iraq. And we hardly speak about that. Now, that family member, a brother, was freed. But it actually goes on all the time between Iraqis.
Yeah, I mean, kidnapping in Iraq is a terrible problem among Iraqis. You know, thousands of people each year, and it's just become epidemic scale. And I think a lot of it doesn't get talked about in the news media, and that's unfortunate. And you know, if the issue can come out more because of Jill's abduction, and people can really look at this and say this is wrong and condemn it, you know, again, from these religious scholars in Iraq who are saying this is wrong, I think the more voices to sort of put a stop to this activity, the better.
And how about the fact that Jill Carroll speaks Arabic? You really did not. I mean, you had a smattering of it. I've got that right?
Well, I studied it for a year and a half, but I wasn't very good at speaking it. I could read it much better.
Right. I mean, do you think if you could have spoken to your abductors, that might have helped?
Well, I did, actually, because I was taken with my translator.
That's right.
And my translator was with me the whole time. So that was incredibly important, was being able to communicate through him to my captors. And I know that, you know, Jill does know a bit of Arabic, and I'm sure she's, you know, doing her best to communicate at this point.
Micah Guerin was held hostage for 10 days when he was in Iraq in August of 2004, filming stolen antiquities, of all things. He and his partner, Marie-Helene Carlton, wrote a book about the experience called American Hostage. Micah, real quick, in the few seconds we have, we know you had a very happy ending to your story. In fact, you came to your senses and asked Marie-Helene to marry you. Have you been married yet?
We're still engaged, and we're trying to decide between France and America.
Well, what are you waiting for? Thanks so much for talking to us, Micah.
Thanks.
Much more coming up here and now. Here and now, and we've been talking about the kidnapping of American journalist Jill Carroll. Her captors said they would kill Carroll today unless U.S. authorities agreed to release all female Iraqi detainees. Iraqi authorities have said that they plan to release 6 of the 8 female detainees, but deny that that's in response to the kidnappers' demands. Well, Anas Altikriti knows about the tensions displayed today in Iraq. Last month, he traveled to Iraq from England to negotiate for the release of 4 kidnapped peace activists. terrorists. He arrived just days before the kidnappers said they would kill their hostages if all Iraqis were not released from prison. Those hostages, Norman Kember of the UK, Tom Fox of the US, and Canadians James Loney and Harmeet Singh Sudan are still missing. Annis has also advised a delegation from the Council on American Islamic Relations that's gone to Iraq to try and secure Jill Carroll's release. And Annis joins us now on the line from his home in Leeds, England. And I'm wondering what you're feeling today.
Well, it's—I have to say—it's very difficult to describe exactly how an emotional roller coaster one goes through when confronted with such a situation. I really have a lot of sympathy for the family and friends and loved ones of Miss Carroll. The feeling that you know the clock is ticking and the deadline is approaching—it just basically has you going through all sorts of feelings. You sway from thinking of the worst to being hopeful and optimistic, and then you get, you know, a phone call saying that, well, maybe we have a breakthrough, and you have the feelings of elation, and then all of a sudden it comes down to earth simply because it turns out that nothing is there.
Well, and as you traveled to Iraq on behalf of the Muslim Association of Britain, you had been there as a child, but it still must have been mind-boggling to arrive in a country as unsettled as Iraq is now, and you'd never done anything like this before. So what was your strategy?
Well, as you said, I think the most difficult thing about it is that, hostage negotiation is something that I hadn't chosen for my career. And obviously you don't want to say something or do something or meet with someone that may jeopardize or threaten the lives of the people that you're trying to, secure the release of. So it was a very, very sensitive issue. But the strategy was this. Basically, the group that kidnapped Norman Kember, Tom Fox and their colleagues were totally unknown. They're totally obscure. No one knows them. And therefore, it was extra difficult simply because we feared that if we were to speak to one particular organization or group and have them show some support to our campaign, they may be adversaries of this particular group of abductors. So basically, the strategy was we speak to everyone and we have them join in our appeal. And that we managed to achieve. So basically, you leave the abductors no space to move. You leave them no one to please by harming the abductors.
Did you speak at all when you were trying to negotiate for the release of the Christian peacekeepers? Did you speak at all to UK or US officials in Iraq?
No, it was absolutely clear from the outset that I did inform the Foreign Office in Britain that I was going. But apart from that, we had no, no coordination whatsoever. I was absolutely clear from the outset that if I was to go under any official guise, whether it be the Iraqi government or whether it be the British or any other governments, then that would possibly irritate or antagonize the abductors.
But on the other hand, did you ever worry that you might actually cause harm to the hostages, that you might have interfered with some sort of secret process that you didn't know anything about?
Of course. Well, that was a major consideration before we actually made the step of me going. And therefore, we made some quite intensive contacts with both the Christian Peacemakers team, the organization, their bases in Chicago, as well as here in London and in Amman, as well as in Iraq. I spoke to them, made sure that they were happy with what I was doing. I made sure to contact the family of the British hostage, Norman Kember, and make sure that they were happy with what I was doing. And then I informed the Foreign Office. So I made absolutely sure that I was liaising with all the relevant parties to this particular incident. When I did go, I made it absolutely sure through every single statement that I issued that I was going in my personal capacity. I wasn't going anywhere near the green zone. I was very much in the so-called red zone. I was an Iraqi, and therefore I was going back home in a sense. I was going to be living with relatives and people that I know, and moving about without any, substantial security guard.
You also had a message of appeasement that, of course, U.S. officials couldn't possibly have, trying to get the message to the abductors that you sympathized with their feelings about the prisons. And we know that Jill Carroll's family has seemed to do the same thing, emphasizing that Jill is someone who cares deeply about the culture of Iraq, that she speaks Arabic, and that she was committed to telling the story of the impact of the war on the Iraqi people. It would seem as if in that way, only someone outside of coalition forces can do this negotiating by sympathizing with the kidnappers' concerns.
I agree. And that was a major consideration when we made our stream of appeals and statements, and we still do. And that is that, you know, basically we're trying to address the abductors themselves, saying, listen, you want the release of the Iraqi detainees, that's a good thing. We want everyone around the world, all Iraqis, want to see an end to the Abu Ghraibs of this world, or to see an end to the secret dungeon cells and the torture chambers that have emerged over the past few years. Everyone wants to see an end to that. But you know, even the group that you're holding on to are people that support that particular cause. In fact, they were in Iraq in order to report back on the situation of Iraqi detainees and their families, and what kind of pressure that those incidents and those events were piling on their lives. So if you truly want to achieve that particular aim, the only way to do it is by releasing the hostages.
The kidnappers of the Christian peacemakers did extend the deadline by 48 hours, but that's been weeks and nothing's been heard since. Do you still have hope that those four hostages are alive?
I still have hope that they are alive, simply because one thing that I've learned in my very short career span in hostage release negotiation is that until you hear the worst, you keep hoping for the best. Maybe they're thinking of changing their demands to financial ones. So maybe, you know, they want to end this, but they want to end this with some sort of financial return or reward. So the possibilities are there. And as I said, until we hear the very worst, we have to keep hoping for the best.
Anas Altaqridi, who went to Iraq on behalf of the Muslim Association of Britain to plea for the release of the four kidnapped Christian peace activists who are still missing. He's also now anxiously awaiting the fate of Jill Carroll, the kidnapped journalist. Anas, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And if there is any news out of Iraq regarding Jill Carroll, we will, of course, bring it to you as soon as possible. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now. A story in USA Today this week caught our eye and cast a spotlight on a largely unknown aspect of adoption. And by the way, this story may not be appropriate for younger or adopted children. The report claims that there is an underground network of families taking in children that adoptive parents no longer want. Reporter Wendy Koch wrote that story for USA Today. She joins us on the line. Hello.
Hi.
This is mind-boggling to read, and it must have been to research. You spoke with one expert on the subject, Dr. Ronald Federici. He called this practice dump and run and said it happens all the time. How frequent is it?
Well, there are no numbers that will tell us how many children may be moved in a private network outside the public welfare system, so we don't really know about the frequency. But those who have more experience in this area, have been personally involved, say that it's not uncommon at all. And really what we're seeing is through private email, chat rooms, that kind of thing, very informal, very below the radar, people who adopt children, most likely abroad, but even domestically, they might get kids who have handicaps, special needs, they just can't handle them. And they need to find another home for them.
Well, in fact, you say that there may be hundreds of websites where people are making these exchanges. How does it work under the radar? What does that mean? How does it work?
Well, you can simply have, there may be chat rooms help each other out of difficult situations. And it's really just, you know, parents sharing problems raising their children. But what will happen in some cases is that someone may say, well, I really just cannot handle this child anymore. And so then informally someone may email that person and say, well, I may know someone who can take this kid off your hands, essentially.
Yeah, a lot of people use the phrase, oh, I got this child through a friend of a friend.
Right. And it's not necessarily anything illegal. No. It's not illegal if you're notifying authorities that you're moving a child. And it does vary if you're a relative or if you're a non-relative, and it will vary state by state.
You write, for instance, in Tennessee, you have to notify authorities if you send a child to another family for more than 30 days.
Right.
Does it become illegal if money changes hands? And does money change hands in these cases you talk of that come out of these chat rooms?
Well, it may not necessarily be illegal if you are formally in the process of adopting a child, and so the subsidy perhaps the child was receiving then transfers to you. All of that can be perfectly fine. A lot of special needs kids, especially those who were adopted domestically, do have government subsidies.
Well, we know that this practice has been revealed through high-profile cases of child abuse. I'm going to hasten to say not everyone who does this is accused of abusing the children. But you've written about the Schmitz family of Tennessee. The state is charging these parents with abusing some of their 18 adopted children, most of whom were disabled. Is this family a well-known part of this network?
Well, certainly they exposed some of this network. Once when I started looking into it, it was very hard to try to penetrate this. But you start talking to families, and, you know, there a lot of the families are defensive, and to some extent understandably so. After a while, though, I did manage to talk to quite a few families. And it's not, as I mentioned, it's not necessarily illegal, but they do kind of move kids around a bit, and if somebody has trouble with a child, another person will take him in.
You spoke with Dr. Federici, as we said. We also spoke with the doctor for this story. He told us that the kids in this underground network were largely adopted from overseas, particularly Eastern Europe, which may mean there's less scrutiny. Did you find that to be true, that a number of these were children who had been adopted overseas?
There is quite a bit of that, and again, we don't know exactly what percent are from abroad, but a couple of the folks told me that it's, you know, public agencies are already overloaded trying to deal with U.S.-born kids, and they really don't want to take these children in. Some of the families, too, don't want to go to the public system because they may have to pay child support if they go to the public system. And
you tell the story of one father who gave up in this underground network to Chinese children he had adopted because they weren't smart enough.
That's what one of the attorneys had told me was the case with two of the children the Schmitzes took in, that these kids per se weren't special needs. They just weren't, according to this
good
one,
enough
dad, what he expected.
Well, Wendy Koch, I wonder overall what you took away from this reporting. We note, for instance, that one of the mothers who was arrested for child abuse, who was picking up children on the Internet, a lot of the websites she used disappeared after her arrest. And I'm wondering, is the sense you get from officials that adoption needs to have more oversight, or will that just drive this sort of off-the-radar swapping underground?
Well, I think clearly there needs to be more oversight. There are so many problems in the child welfare system. It's underfunded, for one thing. I mean, everybody will tell you that. And they've tried to make certain changes to it that are perhaps positive. They've tried to move, shorten the time period that in which kids will be in foster care. But there's all kinds of problems. The states really just don't have enough money to do the monitoring that needs to happen. And you know, some parents who are adopting abroad need to take some responsibility. They really need to go into this with their eyes wide open.
That's Wendy Koch, a reporter for USA Today. She writes about what she calls an underground network of families taking in adopted children that adoptive parents don't want. It's a story that may raise eyebrows. But wait, next week we're going to hear from an adoptive parent who disagrees that this is any kind of secretive underground network. Sharon Meyer is an adoptive mother of 30 children in Florida and the founder of the Foundation for Large Families. Now, she has taken in a child from the Ukraine that the first adoptive parents did not want, a child she heard about through friends. She says children such as hers are not hidden, nor are parents like her who help other adoptive parents doing anything wrong or illegal.
You have to think of it as a private adoption. Every day, women give birth to children. Whatever reason, they give children up. It's a private adoption. You can adopt an adult. Maybe people just don't know about these things, but they've always been legal.
Even if they meet online in a chat room and they say, take my child.
They usually spend a lot of time meeting the family first. It's not like just people coming to your door and, here, take.
But I'm saying, as far as authorities go,
someone somewhere along the line knows. Yes.
Yeah.
It is well known about. What we need more of is support for these families that are bringing children in. There is nothing set up out there for them to learn how to take care of these children, so they don't have to place them for adoption. We need a better mental health care system.
So, is the problem not adoptive parents swapping kids, but parents getting into adoption unprepared for that experience? Next week, we'll have more of our conversation with Sharon Meyer, an adoptive mother of 30 children in Florida, including one that she, as she says, took off the hands of other parents. She's also founder of the Foundation for Large Families. That's next week. Stay ahead. Much more ahead here and now. Well, it's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. Robin Colgrove of Harvard Medical School very much appreciated our report on the rise in diabetes, but added, you referred to type 1 diabetes as genetic and type 2 as more lifestyle-related. Actually, it's more complex than that. Type 1 diabetes, in which patients develop antibodies against their own pancreatic islet cells, does indeed have a strong genetic component. However, the vast majority of people with this same gene do not get diabetes. Therefore, environmental factors must also be in play. In contrast, with type 2 diabetes, if one identical twin gets the disease, there's a 90% chance that the other will as well, suggesting a very strong genetic component. But rates of type 2 diabetes are rising much faster than could be accounted for by genetic changes, so environmental issues and diet and exercise must be at play here as well. Margaret Robinson of Philadelphia did not like our interview with reporter Shayna Rose regarding New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin's recent comments, for which he since apologized, urging blacks to return to New Orleans and make it a chocolate city. The reporter said many whites in the city were concerned that young blacks would interpret the mayor's plea as a call to arms. Well, Margaret said, we shouldn't have aired that comment, and she added, when whites become afraid, black and brown people pay the price. A more fair approach to this story would have included a second interview with the Ninth Ward resident to see how people really feel about the mayor. Well, we recently interviewed Pennsylvania State Representative Gibson Armstrong, who's launched an investigation into possible political bias at state universities. Representative Armstrong pointed to a university want ad looking for a social worker who believes in social justice, which he called socialism. Well, many of you wrote to point out that socialism is a political system in which goods are owned collectively. Rachel Meagerman, who's just received her master's in education and social justice, notes that one could examine the social justice of socialism. Social justice, she writes, or fairness, intrinsically examines the injustice inherent in social structures, examinations of policies, languages, and structures. I'm appalled at the idea that anyone interprets social justice as socialism. Sue Ann, a social worker, writes, I interpreted that line from the ad much differently than Mr. Armstrong did. When I got my Master's of Social Work in 1974, most students were advocates for social justice. I understand that most MSW students today are using the degree to become psychotherapists. No wonder the college wants someone who can inspire students in the areas of community development, advocacy. And by the way, leaders in those areas can have liberal and conservative political views. Well, Keith Hudson of Villanova, Pennsylvania, added one last thought. I heard that Gibson Armstrong objects to the phrase social justice. Does that mean he's in favor of social injustice? Well, now a program note and a thank you to so many of you who wrote after I spoke of the longtime care and then recent death of my mom. What Steve Druschel of Hamilton, Massachusetts called the sudden ending, one that left him exhausted, but also wonderfully and unexpectedly complete. We heard from so many of you caring for parents long distance and in long decline that we're going to air some of your stories next week, along with a closer look at that issue.
Thrown like a star, my vastly wide open my eyes to take a peek, to find that I was by the sea, gazing with tranquility. Just then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love, then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love.
And finally, we heard from our friend and longtime Boston music journalist Dan Gewertz, who said he very much enjoyed our interview with former 60s icon Donovan, whose new autobiography heralds a comeback. But Dan writes, Donovan is currently on a comeback trail, to be sure, but he really didn't retire or leave the music industry as dramatically as he stated. He did put out frequent albums through the 70s, one in the 90s. They didn't sell. I saw him on a booze cruise circling Boston Harbor in 1985. So it was a far less romantic fade-out, not the retirement at the top of his game, Donovan claims. Oh, well. Donovan remains a spinner of tales, including to some extent his own. And by the way, he is still fantastic in concert. Thank you, Dan. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. And now, Oscar Wilde. What does that name conjure up for you? Flamboyance, great wit, homosexuality, or art for art's sake, the motto of the late 19th century Irish literary bon vivant? Oscar Wilde became famous not only for writing The Importance of Being Earnest, one of the English language's greatest comedies, but also for being sent to jail after publicly being called a sodomite by the father of Alfred Lord Douglas, the young nobleman with whom Wilde fell in love. Oscar Wilde's life continues to fascinate more than a century after his death. New biographies, films, and plays have been produced, and now there's a new opera commissioned by the Granite State Opera and composed in New England. Here in Now's Lynn Manigan recently sat down with some of the artists at a rehearsal, and that included composer Thomas Oboe Lee.
You know, I'm actually very surprised that nobody else has written an opera on Oscar Wilde. What happened was I happened to come across a biography of his at a bookstore. And of course, I knew who Oscar Wilde was before, but reading his biography really turned me around. What I was attracted to was this person, this unique individual during Victorian London, and he himself was one man against entire society. And that kind of character, to me, is definitely operatic, number one. And number two, I always loved the underdog. So in that sense, being Chinese, living in America, I feel in some ways I'm an underdog. Being a composer of music that people don't listen to is another underdog category. So I think I was more sympathetic to him as a personality, as an individual, one man against the world. And he suffered for that in the end. And I thought, wow, that would be a great opera.
Why now?
I think there are a lot of reasons, right? Mitt Romney is against gay marriage.
Governor of Massachusetts.
Right.
Possible presidential candidate.
Right. And I'm married to a ballet teacher. I take ballet 4 or 5 times a week. And I'm surrounded by a lot of gay men, and they're wonderful people. So when I find society rejecting them and not allowing them to be married because they love each other, what's wrong with that? So I think this is a great time for Oscar Wilde to come out as an opera.
Like a hyacinth on a sofa, so white and gold, so white and gold. Like a platter of finest china, so blue and white, so blue and white.
You've talked about controversy in the topic, but the music is very melodic and very lush and romantic. They're really songs in this opera, like the operas of old.
Mm-hmm. Paul Hodes wrote this libretto, and so a lot of the songs really came from the words, too, so I have to give him equal credit. I grew up listening to Gershwin. I grew up listening to Cole Porter. Rodgers and Hammerstein are my heroes. So I want an opera that's going to have tunes that people can relate to, that can they can attach to it emotionally.
My love for you is blue and white, the wonder of my white hot night.
And also, Oscar Wilde was a love story between Oscar and Alfred Bosie Douglas. To me, most great operas is all about love. What we're trying to do is write a love story.
My love for you is blue and white. I hold your smooth young body tight.
I'm David Kravitz.
And you are?
Oscar Wilde.
How did you approach the topic of Oscar Wilde? Because it is a controversial one in some circles. And you have to sing lines like, when men could be men with boys in their prime. And I hold your smooth young body tight.
That's... And this is controversial because... No, I'm just kidding. I mean, I think...
And you're singing to a man.
And you're singing to a man. Right, exactly. I think you just have to do what's on the page and with the words, and you got to make them your own. You have to believe what you're saying. And you sort of can't worry about the fact that it may be controversial. I mean, that's for other people to worry about. That's not my problem. My problem is to take the character of Oscar Wilde and as much as I can learn about him and bring to him in my sort of portrayal of him and put it out there. And it's for others to judge whether it's controversial or anything like that.
I'll kill the sod. I'll kill him fast. I'll cut him down. I'll cure his thirst. We'll put him away in Old Bailey's dock, and when we slew him, he'll die of shock. But if I had to shoot him, it's clearly self-defense against a violent, dangerous ruffian whose madness is pretense.
I'm Phil Laureate, Artistic Director of Granite State Opera.
Would it be easier on Ruffian if you held through the B-flat?
I hadn't really planned on making a political statement. It was a great subject in that there are all these passions that are going on in it, and you know, passion between two people, passion between Bosie's father when he comes in is condemning Oscar for seducing his son when actually it was the other way around. There's that passion, and that's something that opera does incredibly well. Is it brings out it's a way to express the passions that you can't get very easily in spoken dialogue.
Through the parted curtains of the window, I see the moon like a clipped piece of silver. The sky is a hard, hollow sapphire. I wish to go into the night.
I like to say it's real. And you think people standing up there screaming, that's not real. It is, you've got real people and acoustically singing their passion and portraying their passion, and you know, an acoustical orchestra generally, and you don't get that on musical stages or whatever. It's coming out of boxes on the side of the stage, so there isn't that visceral connection with the singing that's going on. You will get that in opera, real human passions coming out of real humans and not electronically messed around through a box.
She speaks, and I am the only one to hear her. She smiles, and I am the only one to see her.
It's a very exciting time for the opera world. And I was just reading today how since 1990 there were 200 operas premiered in North America.
Wow, that's exciting. And I think, and I hope that this opera will change some minds. An audience will see a man who was a good person. You know, he lived on a very high moral standard, yet he was ostracized for being different. We're just presenting his life as it is.
The twilight of eternity, I move in wonder past the singing stars.
Oscar Wilde will be performed in a concert version this weekend by New Hampshire's Granite State Opera. For more, go to our website, here-now.org.
Treading light across a dew-drenched field.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.
I wish to go die afar. on us into the night.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.